dozens of display televisions, all tuned to various news channels. I hadn't watched television in months, and suddenly there were TV screens everywhere I looked. Tiny 6-inch kitchen counter TVs stood beside vast 6-foot home theater flat screens and medium-sized living room sets. Vividly colored images were everywhere, in front of us, on the side walls. One enormous television even seemed to be suspended from the ceiling. The sound was off, but as we joined the stunned group of Best Buy staff, we could see that every single television was showing some version of the same scenes, all in the same eerie silence. Planes smashing into glass and metal, and flames pouring out from gashes in the towers. Smoke and fire. Then, unbearably, human bodies jumping and twisting and falling soundlessly through the air. Finally, the towers collapsing in slow motion, one after the other, endlessly, silently replayed. After a few moments, I turned away, sick. Everything will be different now, I thought. The child I'm carrying will be born into a different world. But it doesn't have to be a world in which everything is war. In the years since 9/11, we've slid further and further toward such a grim future. We have allowed the rules and habits of wartime to pervade ordinary life, blinding us to the ways in which we're becoming both less principled and less secure. The horrors of 9/11 can't be wished away any more than we can wish away the brutality of ISIS, the looming specter of catastrophic climate change, or the coming era of bioengineered threats and autonomous weapons. Reality will always be crueler and less orderly than the neat rules and categories we humans try to create, but this is no reason to abandon our efforts to tame and constrain the human capacity for violence, or give up on our efforts to ensure that power is exercised fairly and accountably. History tells us that rules and rituals can lose their force over time or be turned to different ends, but history also tells us that we need to keep trying. War's paradoxes can never be fully resolved, but with creativity and determination, they can, perhaps, be managed more justly and sensibly. Lawmaking is an imaginative enterprise. Legislators, diplomats, and policymakers look at the existing world, project onto it an image of a better, tidier future, and then try to develop contingency plans for dealing with various forms of future untidiness. Thus, the mid-20th century diplomats who negotiated the UN Charter, the Geneva Conventions, and the core human rights treaties took the raw materials at hand, drawn from older legal documents and customs, and coupled these with their own searing sense of what had gone wrong in the World War just ended. By laying out new rules for a world more orderly than the one they had inherited, they hoped to encourage life to imitate law, and for a time it almost worked. Inevitably, the post-World War II legal and institutional framework was slightly out of date from the moment it was created. The law speaks of civilians and combatants, of states and organized armed forces under responsible command, of international peace and security, and domestic affairs. But there have always been actors and actions that didn't fit into these neat boxes. In the decades immediately following World War II, the world saw plenty of partisans and guerrillas, for instance, along with terrorist groups ranging from the Irish Republican Army to violent Basque separatists. Proxy conflicts in Africa, Asia, and Latin America put pressure on international rules relating to sovereignty and the use of force, as did the covert action and espionage of the Cold War era. For decades, the number of things that didn't fit stayed well clear of the tipping point. It was only after 9/11 that the categories and rules of the post-World War II world became fundamentally incoherent. Look further back in time, and there have been many other moments in which the post-World War II categories so familiar to most of us could not have been easily applied. The British East India Company was, for the better part of 200 years, part profit-making private company, part government, and part army. And it wasn't unique. Throughout history, all these categories have frequently been murky. Along with the lines between pirate and naval officer, bandit leader and feudal lord, mercenary and patriot, citizen and soldier. And these categories are culture-specific. As our brief foray into history and anthropology demonstrated, virtually all human societies have sought to draw clear lines between war and peace, warriors and non-warriors. But they have drawn these lines in quite different places at different times, used different rituals in an attempt to keep them clear, and found, repeatedly, that every line they drew eventually had to be redrawn. Perhaps the problem we face today is not that categories which have long been clear have suddenly become hazy. Perhaps the problem is that we briefly convinced ourselves of the permanence and clarity of lines drawn in sand. Perhaps the anomaly we should study is not the recent emergence of line-blurring threats, such as transnational terrorism or cyber attacks, but that strange and halcyon period between World War II and the 9/11 attacks, in which we in the West thought we had finally figured it all out. We thought we understood the world around us and could lock into place the international order best suited to maintaining peace and stability and enabling humans to thrive. We built a global system based on the assumption that the state is the ultimate and best form of human social organization and convinced ourselves that war could be locked in a box and made subject to unchanging rules. But though the current blurriness may be less historically anomalous than we often assume, one important thing has changed in the years since the British East India Company controlled an entire subcontinent. We live today in the age of human rights. Human rights may not be universally respected, but the idea of human rights is now almost universally accepted, with its promises of dignity, fairness, and justice. 200 or 300 years ago, very few individuals had high expectations of their states or rulers. Few people dared to imagine that opportunities should be equal, or that hereditary governing privilege was wrong, or that governments should be accountable to their people, or that power should only be exercised in accordance with fair rules. Virtually no one imagined, except in their most utopian dreams, that the nations and peoples of the world should all be expected, even perhaps required, to work together for good, to feed the hungry, help the victims of natural disasters, or collaborate to stop repression, slaughter, and war. After the carnage of World War II, the dream of human rights spread rapidly around the globe, along with dreams of democracy and rule of law. And over the course of little more than a century, human expectations have changed radically, not for everyone on Earth, but for many people, all around the globe. As a result, the weakened constraints on state power that stem from the blurring, or re-blurring, of lines between war and peace trouble us today as they might not have troubled our great-grandparents. Today, our expectations are different and higher. We no longer accept predation by the powerful as inevitable. Instead, we view it as something that should be eliminated. We no longer consider government secrecy entirely acceptable. Today, most of us believe that governments have an obligation to be transparent and accountable, with only narrow exceptions. We no longer consider sudden violent death at the hands of government authorities something that can be expected to happen with some degree of frequency. We view it as shocking. All this could change once more. The globalization of the human rights discourse has never been entirely consistent, and it may not endure. But if we believe that a world in which governments respect basic rights and the rule of law is a better world than one in which they don't, we should be troubled by the recent blurring and expansion of war. If the rules we have created for wartime stay the same, but war continues to expand, we will eventually find ourselves living permanently under wartime rules, with their reduced constraints on lethal force and reduced expectations about accountability. Back in 1999, Chinese Army colonels Chow and Wang warned that when the boundaries between war and non-war, military and non-military, have eroded, both law and mortality will begin to lose their force. If the boundaries between war and non-war are socially constructed, that doesn't make them any less vital. If we can't figure out whether or not there's a war, or where the war is located, or who's a combatant in that war and who's a civilian, we have no way of deciding whether, where, or to whom the law of war applies. And if we can't figure out what legal rules apply, we lose any principled basis for making the most vital decisions a democracy can make. What is the appropriate sphere for the military? When can a government have secret laws, and when must government decisions and actions be submitted to public scrutiny? Which communications and activities can be monitored, and which should be free of government eavesdropping? What matters can the courts decide, and what matters should be beyond the scope of judicial review? Who can be imprisoned, for how long, and with what degree, if any, of due process? When can lethal force be used inside the borders of a sovereign country? Who is a duck, and who is a rabbit? Ultimately, who lives, and who dies? It may be tempting to shrug all this off as unduly melodramatic. Yes, the world is changing, and our laws and institutions may now be badly out of sync with the realities of the world in which we live, but why treat this as an urgent problem requiring our collective attention? Throughout history, we humans have always managed, eventually, to adapt our laws and institutions in response to changing technologies and changing conditions. Somehow, we've always managed to muddle through. This shouldn't be a source of much comfort. True, the human species has always muddled through, but the muddling through has generally been a slow, brutal, and agonizing process. Think of the major inflection points in the modern international order: the Peace of Westphalia, or the post-World War II creation of the UN Charter System. Despite the teleological fervor of some history and international law books, the bursts of creativity and change symbolized by the emergence of the post-Westphalian nation-state, or the UN system, were not the happy culmination of decades or centuries of peaceful evolution. On the contrary, these dramatic changes in the international system arose out of cataclysm. The religious wars that racked Europe before the Peace of Westphalia left nearly a third of the population dead in much of Central Europe. World Wars I and II were nearly as devastating, leaving tens of millions dead and many of Europe's great cities in ruins. Out of the ashes, we developed new categories, new rules, and new institutions, ones that worked better, for a time at least. But the process wasn't much fun for the humans who had to live through it. It was even less fun for the humans who didn't live through it. Perhaps we'll muddle through once more, and our laws and institutions will evolve in constructive ways without need of any anxious efforts to steer them. But perhaps they won't. Perhaps today's international system will gradually and peacefully morph into a more stable, equitable, and effective system of global governance without any conscious collective effort on our part. But perhaps it won't. Perhaps instead we'll get an increasingly repressive and Orwellian state, and an increasingly vicious and unstable international order. Perhaps the current system will collapse as catastrophically as the pre-World War II international order. Change is inevitable, but not inevitably for the better. Even when the ultimate outcome is good, the process of change may be neither pleasant nor gentle. It will take both a concerted effort and a whole lot of luck for us to stagger and stumble our way toward a stronger, more stable, and more human rights-friendly system of law and institutions. If we don't bother to make an effort and we run out of luck, we could find ourselves all too quickly back in an era of domestic repression and bloody global conflict. What is to be done? Since the 9/11 attacks, the blurring of the boundaries between war and peace has enabled successive presidential administrations to embrace indefinite detention, massive secret surveillance programs, covert cross-border targeted killings, the use of military force outside the UN Charter framework, and a host of other troubling practices. We've also seen the steady militarization of U.S. foreign policy as our military has been assigned many of the tasks once given to civilian institutions, and the steady trickling down of war-related doctrines and practices into ordinary law, law enforcement, and domestic politics. So what is to be done? The easiest option is to bury our heads deeply in the sand and pretend nothing has changed. We can pretend that wars are temporary, bounded, and exceptional affairs, that the current war on terror is fundamentally no different from World War I or World War II, and that peace is the norm to which we will shortly and inevitably return. Most Americans are selecting this first option because to do otherwise requires us to face too many frightening realities. A second option is to try to jam war back into its old box. We can denounce U.S. government practices and legal interpretations that undermine human rights and the rule of law, and insist that the root of the problem is a simple category mistake. The United States has labeled as war too many things that should correctly be labeled crime or social problems, and labeled as military too many tasks that should properly be labeled civilian. If the root of our current problems is a category mistake, the way to remedy these problems is to urge politicians, policymakers, military leaders, and judges to recognize that counterterrorism should not truly be conceived of as war, any more than the war on drugs or the war on poverty led us to apply the law of armed conflict to those efforts. Similarly, this argument would suggest that we should stop viewing cyber threats, economic threats, and a dozen other threats through the lens of war, and return to our pre-9/11 understanding of the world. This is the approach that has been taken by many in the human rights and civil rights communities since 9/11. But a decade and a half after those planes crashed into the Twin Towers, this approach is a waste of time and energy, and an exercise in self-deception. We can argue all we want about category errors and the importance of ridding ourselves of the war paradigm, but events march inexorably on. The war on terrorism continues to open new fronts, from Syria and Libya to Mali and Nigeria, and it's hard to see this changing under any future administration, Democratic or Republican. It's difficult to imagine any politician, judge, or elected leader declaring the war on terrorism over or labeling it a 15-year mistake. Regardless, trying to jam war back into its old box rests on a faulty assumption about the world we live in. Messy forms of conflict have always been part of human reality, and most likely always will be. Until we accept this, the post-9/11 erosion of human rights is likely to continue. Paradoxical as it may seem, the best route to upholding human rights and the rule of law lies in accepting that some degree of global violence, conflict, and coercion is likely to remain the norm, not the exception. The best route to upholding human rights and the rule of law lies in recognizing that war and peace are not binary opposites, but lie along a continuum. This is our third and best option. We can accept the world as it is, but change the categories we use to make sense of it, and develop new rules and institutions to manage the paradoxes of perpetual war. We humans created the categories, rules, and institutions under which we live, and if they are no longer doing the work we want them to do, we should change them. We call ourselves Homo sapiens, but we might more accurately describe ourselves as Homo categoricus. It is in our nature to create categories: plants, animals, wet, dry, good, evil, ducks, rabbits, raw, cooked, us, them, war, peace. As psychologist Jerome Bruner wrote in a famous 1957 essay, "Whatever is perceived is placed in and achieves its meaning from a class of percepts with which it is grouped." To Bruner, it doesn't necessarily matter whether the categories we create correspond to something real and external to our minds, to the world of noumena, in Kant's formulation, rather than the world of phenomena. To categorize is to assign meaning, and to be human is to be a seeker of meaning. We see a drawing of what could be either a duck or a rabbit, and in the absence of other cues, we don't know how to make sense of it. We see an adult slap a child's cheek. Until we identify the correct category for the act we have seen, we don't know how to react. Was it child abuse? Parental discipline? Part of a game? An accident? An effort to squash a mosquito before it could bite? End a dangerous fit of hysterics? We need context to determine the right category. If we also see the same adult drunkenly insult or beat the same child, we'll categorize the slap as child abuse. If we see the adult laugh and slap at a buzzing mosquito on his own arm, we'll categorize the slap quite differently. Legal categories also assign meaning. In particular, law is one of the most important mechanisms human societies have developed to give moral meaning to aggression, violence, suffering, and death. Every human society experiences some degree of conflict and suffering, and a central question for every society is how to make sense of the kinds of violence and suffering that occur. In societies without law in the modern sense, myths, customs, and rituals reinforce the categorizations that give moral meaning to violence. Stories, songs, and symbols may tell us, for instance, that killing a relative is bad, but killing an enemy from another group is good, or that death in battle is blessed, while death through illness is shameful, or that illness is sent by God to test a person's mettle, or is caused by witchcraft and must be avenged, or that a brave person turns the other cheek. There are as many ways to organize and make sense of violence and suffering as there have been human societies in the world. In modern states, legal process is itself a form of ritual. Law, to use anthropologist Paul Bohannon's phrase, is a set of double institutionalized norms. It consists of norms that first solidify into customs, then are given additional power through their incorporation into the formal mechanisms of the law: police, courts, trials, prisons. Formal law is most effective when its rituals are widely acknowledged as meaningful and appropriate, and when the norms and customs it embodies are widely shared by its subjects. But whether or not law's subjects regard it as legitimate, law always represents an effort, at least on the part of those who create and interpret it, to organize and give moral and social meaning to violence and suffering. Law doesn't necessarily operate to reduce violence and suffering, but it labels and categorizes it. Law labels violence as socially beneficial or socially detrimental, deliberate or accidental, preventable or inevitable. Through law, we plant moral flags. Through law, we tell people how we want them to behave and where we want our society to go. One person kills another. The law tells us how to regard this killing. It gives us categories for attaching moral meaning to the killing. If we label it accidental or self-defense, it is excusable. If it was a wartime killing of an enemy, it was heroic. If it was none of those things, it will be condemned and punished as murder. Modern U.S. law defines most state-sponsored violence as good or appropriate violence, while defining most private violence as bad. Thus, the pain and suffering caused by imprisonment or the death penalty are deemed acceptable, while the murderer's acts fill most of us with horror and are punished by the law. Recall the story of Dražen Erdemović and the International Criminal Tribunal's struggle to decide his fate. Erdemović killed scores of innocent civilians at Srebrenica, but he did so under duress. His commander told him that if he didn't follow orders, he could stand in line with the doomed civilians, and we will kill you, too. Yet the tribunal insisted on punishing Erdemović as a criminal, not because the judges doubted his story or thought they would have acted differently themselves, or because they thought his continued resistance might have saved lives, but because they believed that legal rules should reflect what ought to be, not merely what is. The law, they insisted, should not be the product or slave of logic or intellectual hair-splitting, but must serve broader normative purposes in light of its social, political, and economic role. There is no avoiding the essential relationship between law and politics. The law should serve as a warning and a guide, reminding us that the contours of darkness are as indistinct as the contours of war, and the future will be the one we choose. War is interested in you. I do not believe America's interests are served by endless war or by remaining on a perpetual war footing, President Obama said on February 11, 2015. That this statement came as the president asked Congress to authorize military force against yet another enemy, the Islamic State this time, was an irony lost on few observers. No modern politician will praise war. American political culture regards war as an occasional but regrettable necessity at best, and more often as a tragic and avoidable failure. Either way, we persist in viewing war as the exception and peace as the norm. As President Obama put it in a different speech, our systematic effort to dismantle terrorist organizations must continue, but this war, like all wars, must end. That's what history advises. But history advises no such thing. As we have seen, some degree of war has been the norm for much of human history, and pure peace has been the exception, though we Americans have been largely blind to this reality. Foreign attacks on U.S. soil have been few and far between, and for most of our history, our wars have been fought by a small and highly professionalized military, making them largely invisible to the bulk of the population. The American Civil War, one of the few to visit its harms on the nation as a whole, occasioned the first U.S. government effort to codify the laws of armed conflict. Modern times are distinguished from earlier ages by the existence, at one and the same time, of many nations and great governments related to one another in close intercourse, declared the Libre Code. Peace is their normal condition. War is the exception. The ultimate object of all modern war is a renewed state of peace. This was an optimistic perspective in 1863, coming, as it did, in the middle of a century kicked off in Europe by the Napoleonic Wars, which lasted for over a decade and killed more than 3 million people, and during a bloody civil war that killed some 2% of the U.S. population. The 19th century was racked by conflict, from uprisings in Serbia and Greece to the Crimean War and the Wars of Italian Unification. The preceding centuries were marred by even more widespread conflict, punctuated less by periods of peace than by periods of smaller-scale conflicts. Look back further, and the same is true. As historian Michael Howard puts it in The Invention of Peace, Archaeological, anthropological, as well as all surviving documentary evidence indicates that war, armed conflict between organized political groups, has been the universal norm in human history. The century that followed the Liber Code's historical misremembering was no better. Two world wars wiped out tens of millions, to say nothing of the numerous non-Western conflicts that engulfed parts of Africa, Asia, and Latin America. The United States, too, was in a state of near-constant conflict throughout the 20th century, with two world wars supplemented by Korea, Vietnam, and more than a dozen small wars, not to speak of the numerous Central American, Asian, and African Cold War proxy wars fomented or intervened in by the United States. There's little reason to expect something different from the 21st century. In the century's first 15 years, the United States has already fought two large-scale ground wars, one in Iraq and one in Afghanistan, and used air power and special operations forces to kill perceived enemies in a dozen other places, from Pakistan, Yemen, and Libya, to Somalia, the Philippines, and Syria. As I write, there are U.S. military personnel stationed in almost every country in the world. Violence and conflict are escalating in both the Middle East and Central Asia, and the United States is getting pulled back into conflicts we thought were over. The stunning rise of the Islamic State is yet another reminder that turning the page on war is easier said than done. As Leon Trotsky's grim quip puts it, "You may not be interested in war, but war is interested in you." The notion that states can monopolize violence seems increasingly quaint. The technologies of destruction are cheap and widely available, and acts of brutality can easily be broadcast on YouTube and Twitter. New methods of warfare continue to emerge, from fully autonomous robot weapons and DNA-linked bioweapons to a range of non-lethal mechanisms of coercion and control. Meanwhile, potential causes of global conflict are plentiful. Tensions between the United States and Russia are higher today than at any period since the end of the Cold War, and tensions with China are increasing. Cyber attacks are rising, and climate change is creating new spheres of competition over water and other resources. Warfare will keep changing, but it's unlikely to disappear. We are, as the military puts it, in an era of persistent conflict. It won't end soon. "War appears to be as old as mankind, but peace is a modern invention," wrote Sir Henry Maine in 1888. This isn't a fashionable sentiment, and for most of us, accepting that wartime is unlikely to end goes against the grain. We resist seeing war and peace as points along a continuum. We long for them to be starkly differentiated. Like the Makeo of Papua New Guinea, we recognize on some level that war is toxic. If allowed to leach into ordinary life, it may destroy all that we value. It is because so much is at stake that we humans have dedicated so much energy over the millennia to policing the lines between war and peace. In wartime, we permit violence and coercion that we deem immoral and illegal in peacetime, and we permit these wartime deviations from the usual peacetime rules because, despite war's historical frequency, we persist in viewing it as an exceptional state of affairs. There are many things we are willing to tolerate on an exceptional basis, but not if they become the norm. Thus, indefinite detention for the duration of the conflict is one thing if a conflict is likely to last for 2 years or five or even 10. It's another thing altogether when a conflict can confidently be expected to last a lifetime. The suspension of civil liberties is one thing during an emergency of short duration and another thing over the long term. The killing of human beings without due process or any mechanisms for accountability is one thing in the trenches of World War I, and another thing when the killings can take place anywhere on Earth at any time against an ill-defined, non-uniformed, and changing foe. When war is relatively bounded, when it is something that happens in a defined place and time, and involves a clearly defined group of actors, we can tolerate its relatively unconstrained violence. But the nature of modern security threats resists our efforts at categorization. In a war against a geographically diffuse terrorist network, the spatial boundaries of conflict are necessarily arbitrary. A war against constantly morphing organizations that often lack centralized leadership structures cannot end with a peace treaty. A war against a constantly changing set of actors who move from place to place and from organization to organization can have no clearly defined enemy. Some may be inclined to dismiss the increasing haziness of the boundaries between war and peace as merely a product of disingenuous U.S. government rhetoric, but they are wrong to do so. No question, there has been plenty of disingenuous rhetoric, but the changes in the geopolitical landscape are real, significant, and most likely irreversible. Revolutionary technological changes have reduced the salience of state borders and physical territory, and increased the lethality and disruptive capabilities of non-state actors and even individuals. The changes that have blurred the lines between war and peace are real, not just figments of militaristic American imaginations. But the fact that they are real doesn't lessen the degree to which these changes are undermining hard-won global gains in human rights and the rule of law. Most of the institutions and laws designed to protect rights and prevent the arbitrary or abusive exercise of state power rest on the assumption that we can readily distinguish between war and peace. When there is no longer any consistent or principled way to do so, many of our existing legal frameworks become little more useful to us than the lines Navajo warriors once drew in the sand. It's time to stop relying on lines drawn in the sand. The wind and waves are washing them away. We can deny that any of this is happening, or we can try to shoehorn war back into its box, insisting on an end to the war on terror, a wholesale rejection of the war paradigm, and a return to the law enforcement framework that we associate with times of peace. But our best option is to focus instead on developing norms and institutions that support human rights and the rule of law, but are not premised on the existence of sharp lines between war and peace. If we recognize war not as a rare state of exception, but as a constant companion to human affairs, and thus something that requires permanent management rather than episodic denial, we can, perhaps, develop rules and institutions for the space that lies between total war and total peace. As legal historian Mary Dudziak puts it in her book, Wartime, military conflict has been ongoing for decades, yet public policy rests on the false assumption that it is an aberration. This enables a culture of irresponsibility, as wartime serves as an argument and an excuse for national security-related ruptures of the usual legal order. If we abandon the idea that war is confined in time, we can see more clearly that our law and politics are not suspended by an exception to the regular order of things. Wartime has become the only time we have, and therefore it is a time when American politics must function. A cultural framing of wartimes as discrete and temporary occasions, destined to give way to a state of normality, undermines democratic vigilance. It's time to accept that war and peace are not binary opposites, but rather the outer limits of a continuum. Indeed, add in cyber, individualized weapons, and various non-lethal forms of coercion and control, and a two-dimensional continuum may not be enough. We may need to conceptualize warfare in three dimensions, or even more. For now, though, let's stick with the world we inhabit today, in which we already find ourselves, more often than not, operating in the murky territory between what we traditionally conceptualize as war and what we traditionally conceptualize as peace. In the last few years, more and more thinkers have tried to find a way to label and describe this murky terrain. The Army's Special Operations Command calls it the missing middle, while Nora Bensahel of the Center for a New American Security and retired Lieutenant General David Barno call it a gray zone between traditional notions of war and peace. They write, "Gray zone conflicts are not formal wars, and little resemble traditional, conventional conflicts between states. They involve some aggression or use of force, but in many ways their defining characteristic is ambiguity. About the ultimate objectives, the participants, whether international treaties and norms have been violated, and the role that military forces should play in response." Gray zone conflicts abound in today's world. Each of these confrontations is characterized by hybrid threats that may combine subversion, destabilizing social media influence, disruptive cyber attacks, and anonymous little green men, instead of recognizable armed forces making overt violations of international borders. Nadia Shadlow, a former Defense Policy Board member now at the Smith-Richardson Foundation, offers a different formulation, arguing that the United States must learn to operate in the space between war and peace. This space is not an empty one, she argues, but a landscape churning with political, economic, and security competitions that require constant attention. And the United States needs an active operational approach to managing that space between peace and war. The space between. What would it mean in practice to manage this churning, changing space between? To develop laws, politics, and institutions premised on the assumption that we will forever remain unable to draw sharp boundaries between war and peace, and that we will frequently find ourselves in the space between. This will be the work of many minds and many years, but the task is surely not impossible if we remind ourselves that we human beings can make and unmake categories and rules. And it is surely not inconsistent with the core principles enshrined both in America's founding documents and in human rights law, that life and liberty are unalienable rights, that no person should be arbitrarily deprived of these rights, and that no one, no individual, no organization, no government, and no state, should be permitted to exercise power without being held accountable for mistakes or abuses. If we take these principles seriously, we might, for instance, develop better mechanisms to prevent arbitrariness, mistake, and abuse in targeted killings. At the moment, debates about targeted strikes, whether conducted via drones, manned aircraft, or special operations forces, fall prey to meaningless war-peace dichotomies. Some insist that no person should be executed by the state without the full range of due process protections provided by criminal law, while others insist that fighting wars effectively requires that we accept a high risk of mistake, since judicial oversight of the battlefield would be absurd and unduly burdensome. But there is surely an alternative: better laws and institutions. Threats in the space between often bring with them an urgency rarely encountered in a traditional law enforcement context, and sometimes a related need for at least temporary secrecy. At the same time, laws and institutions designed for an age when ongoing decentralized threats are the norm rather than the exception should be more rigorous in oversight, with greater transparency and more effective accountability mechanisms than would be required in a hot conflict between states on a temporally and territorially bounded battlefield. In hot wars, we all understand the absurdity of requiring judicial approval prior to battlefield killings. You couldn't have military lawyers opining on targeting decisions during the invasion of Normandy, much less judges. Allied soldiers were much too busy just trying to stay alive. In any case, we could reasonably assume that virtually everyone present on the beaches of Normandy was a combatant. Meanwhile, in law enforcement settings, we all understand the dangers of failing to require judicial oversight of police searches, arrests, and uses of force. Ordinary crime is mostly individual and episodic, and the harm it does to society and the innocent is relatively contained. In these circumstances, it's reasonable to expect a higher degree of due process and after-the-fact judicial scrutiny. U.S. targeted killings lie in the space between. They involve the use of military force against individuals who hope to inflict harm far exceeding that associated with ordinary crime, and they often take place in geographic areas in which ordinary law enforcement activities are impossible. The area is physically inaccessible or too violent and disorderly for the slow work of policing to succeed. At the same time, U.S. targeted strikes aren't spur-of-the-moment actions against targets of opportunity. Those we kill have often been on kill lists for weeks, months, and even years. The precise moment of a strike may be opportunistic, but officials have had plenty of time to consider evidence and make decisions about status and threat. The logic underlying the law of armed conflict's permissive rules on status-based killing doesn't apply here. In the space between, unlike the beaches of Normandy, there's plenty of time for careful process, including some judicial or quasi-judicial process, before an individual goes on a list of those who can be killed. There's also plenty of time afterward to review strikes, determine if any mistakes were made, compensate victims for damages, and review or change procedures to prevent similar mistakes in the future. So why not develop categories, rules, institutions, and processes that take this into account? Already, several scholars and policy experts, myself included, have outlined a number of ways to bring greater transparency and accountability to U.S. targeted strikes, ranging from independent commissions with the power to review targeting policies and pass strikes, to judicial bodies that might issue strike warrants or order damages for inappropriate strikes. None of the current proposals completely fixes the problem, but there are many straightforward and feasible ways to improve on the current situation, if Congress and the White House choose to do so. Much the same could be said of detention, surveillance, and secrecy in the space between. In this murky middle space, we need to reevaluate all our assumptions, neither mechanically seeking to apply the laws of war nor mechanically applying law enforcement and peacetime rules. We should focus not on trying to jam activities in the space between into the old categories, war, peace, foreign, domestic, and so on, but on ensuring that this space, like every space, remains a zone subject to the rule of law. Ultimately, the concept of the space between probably won't offer enough precision. We may need to identify multiple different points along the continuum between war and peace, and develop different rules and accountability mechanisms for each. But to do this, we will need to abandon our obsession with forcing everything into outmoded categories, and instead keep our focus on protecting human dignity, preventing the arbitrary exercise of power, increasing predictability, and ensuring accountability. We will need to do this on at least three different levels: the level of the individual, the level of the state, and the level of the international system. With regard to individuals, our goal should be the development of categories, rules, and institutions that balance the right of each individual to life, liberty, and fair process with the need to protect others. With regard to the nation, we need categories, rules, and institutions that enable meaningful democratic control of government decisions that affect liberty and lives. With regard to the international system, we need categories, rules, and institutions that prevent powerful states from committing abuses with impunity behind the cloak of state sovereignty, but that also prevent the instability that would result from expanding a unilateral right to use force. Bluntly, the United States will need to accept some further loss of sovereignty in exchange for more just and effective mechanisms for solving collective global problems. No state can combat disease, climate change, or international terrorist organizations on its own, but any state can play a destructive and destabilizing role on its own. If we don't want to keep setting precedents that will come back to haunt us, we will need to learn how to share power, authority, and resources with other states, on issues from targeted killings and surveillance policy to refugee flows and the emerging technologies likely to shape future warfare. Doing this will go beyond tinkering with Security Council voting and membership rules. We will need to thoroughly overhaul existing international governance structures and pour both money and diplomatic energy into persuading other powerful states to join us. None of this will be easy or uncontroversial, and technologies will continue to evolve, continually creating new challenges. But none of this should be impossible. On the level of individuals, we already have decent models for protecting individuals from the arbitrary exercise of state power, while also protecting society from the harm that can be inflicted by malevolent individuals. On the level of the nation, we can look to existing democratic accountability and oversight regimes for ways to bring the space between under the rule of law. Even on the global level, where rule of law and governance traditions are weakest, we don't need to start entirely from scratch. Strong and effective international institutions already oversee and adjudicate many significant economic interactions, for instance, and even the globe's most powerful states have willingly consented to allowing institutions such as the World Trade Organization to limit and constrain their economic activities. We can look to some of these institutions for ideas that may also be useful in governing state activities in the space between war and peace. And what about the military? What about the human institutions that make up our foreign policy and national security establishments? The State Department, the United States Agency for International Development, the Defense Department, the intelligence community, and so on. They too will need to be reimagined and reformed to operate effectively and responsibly in the space between. And here again, we will need to abandon our fixation on the artificial lines we have drawn and focus instead on how to organize our government to do what we need and want it to do. At the moment, U.S. civilian military tensions remain high. As the military continues to expand its activities into traditionally civilian spheres, we keep going in circles with the usual sterile debates. Are we witnessing the militarization of U.S. foreign policy? Shouldn't the military stick to what it's good at? Drilling, training to shoot, conducting military exercises, and, if needed, actually fighting, and leave development, governance, information activities, humanitarian aid, and so on to civilian experts? In response to such concerns, military officials usually offer a somewhat half-hearted defense. They concede that in an ideal world, such activities would be undertaken by a reinvigorated civilian sector, but note that civilian agencies currently lack the needed resources and capacity, creating a temporary need for the military to fill the gaps between what national security requires and what the civilian sector can provide. This is an unsatisfying state of affairs for all concerned. Advocates of civilian power watch in dismay as the military takes on more and more jobs that, in their view, ought to be done by civilian agencies, and proceeds much of the time to do them badly. Since the military has only recently come to see these activities as part of its mission, its doctrine, training, and skills inevitably lag behind. For many military personnel, the current situation is equally frustrating. If civilian agencies lack the resources and capacity to undertake critical missions on an appropriate scale, the military is more or less forced to step in, taking on unfamiliar jobs and subject to little but criticism from their civilian agency counterparts. Both military and civilian leaders frequently assert that the key to resolving this uncomfortable situation is to reinvigorate the government's civilian agencies, restoring them, at a minimum, to their Cold War funding levels. But the hope, or I should say pretense, that one of these days civilian agencies will be funded at a level adequate to take over these activities from the military is becoming a dangerous delusion. There's virtually no chance that Congress and the executive branch will summon up the resources or the political will to reinvigorate the government's civilian sector. And in any case, as we know, the lines between civilian and military tasks are arbitrary to begin with. Just as it's a mistake to imagine that we can shove war back into a neat box, it's a mistake to imagine that we will someday be able to simply return our government agencies to their traditional roles and missions. Such a fantasy lands us in the worst of all possible worlds, one in which the military continues to expand into traditionally civilian missions, but does so in an ad hoc and often ambivalent manner rather than a planned and thoughtful way. After all, to do otherwise would require a politically unpalatable acknowledgement that the degradation of the civilian sector is likely irreversible. We need to think about military and civilian roles in a very different way. Try two thought experiments. First, imagine what the civilian sector would look like if the military could reinvent it, freed from all constraints. If we take at their word the many defense officials who insist that the military is only engaged in development, reconstruction, rule of law, information campaigns, and so forth, because the civilian sector currently lacks capacity and resources, what capacities and resources would civilian agencies need to return to their traditional role? If we want the civilian sector to expand so it can respond rapidly, flexibly, and effectively to prevent conflicts and promote stability and reconstruction, how big would the international affairs budget need to be? How many more people, with what skills, would civilian agencies need? And is it remotely realistic to imagine that this will happen anytime in the next few decades, given current political and fiscal realities? If the answer to that last question is no, and I am afraid it is, move on to the second thought experiment. Imagine what the U.S. military would need to do. Imagine the required skills, resources, personnel, and organizational changes if we were to accept that waiting for a reinvigorated civilian sector is like waiting for Godot. How might the Defense Department need to change in the coming decades to prevent and respond with agility, not only to conventional military threats, but to the complex and often inchoate threats that may stem from cyber attacks, refugee flows driven by climate change, ethnic conflict, economic collapse, or terrorist efforts to develop biological weapons? To develop the needed capabilities, the military would have to start looking a whole lot more like a civilian agency itself. Within a single large but agile organization, traditional military skills would have to be fully integrated with traditional civilian skills, including expertise in development, education, public health, governance, communications, and languages and cultures. Today, threats don't come neatly packaged as civilian versus military threats, and to operate effectively in the space between, we'll need to knock down the walls we've created between our civilian agencies and the military. Here, too, knocking down walls will be difficult, but not impossible. Imagine if we stopped calling the military, and instead recognized that national security depends on many different things, from the strength and quality of our schools, roads, and hospitals, to the creativity we can bring to solving global problems like climate change. Sometimes our national security interests and global stability will require us to use coercive and destructive technologies. Rwanda, Bosnia, Syria, and Iraq aren't one-time glitches in a peaceful world order, but recurring themes. And sometimes the United States and other capable global actors will need to use force to respond. But despite the inherent risks, the lines we draw between those who carry guns and those who carry stethoscopes and hammers will need to become more porous. War, for all its horrors, has long been one of the best and only means of harnessing collective human talent and energy to serve the group as a whole. And the military has long been the institution we use to bring talent together. If the military is becoming everything, why not use this as an opportunity to engage everyone, to include millions more Americans in the project of making the nation stronger and the world a little less cruel? Imagine a revamped public sector premised on the idea of universal service, an America in which every young man and woman spends a year or two engaged in work that fosters national and global security. Some might choose to carry the traditional weapons of a soldier, some might teach or build roads, some might write computer code to protect vulnerable systems, some might work on international development or public health projects. Expensive, at least in the near term? Yes. Though a universal service program would also be a massive investment in a safer, stronger future. An investment that would ultimately pay off 100 times over. Ambitious? Yes. But in this, as in so much else, we're held back not by the laws of physics, or even the laws of politics, but only by our limited imaginations. Every grand undertaking seems impossible until it happens. 300 years ago, American independence must have seemed impossible. 200 years ago, ending slavery seemed impossible. 100 years ago, the establishment of Social Security and Medicare was a pipe dream. Reimagining the military and combining it with a broad program of universal national service would be complicated, and in the short run, expensive. But in the long run, how else can we harness the creativity, energy, and talent we will need in this uncertain and dangerous world? Most of us cringe reflexively at the idea of a vastly expanded military, one that takes on an ever broader range of traditionally civilian activities as our civilian agencies, defunded and demoralized, shrink gradually into irrelevance. But aside from intellectual laziness and sheer habit, nothing solid stands behind our instinct that this would be a dangerous state of affairs. As we know, the terms military and civilian weren't handed down by a divine power. They are human constructs, and the assumption that there are and must be sharp lines between the two is of relatively recent vintage. When critics lament the militarization of foreign policy, they often point to the diminution of civilian control over the military, worrying that any expansion of responsibilities, resources, and power in the same organization that controls so many lethal weapons is inherently dangerous. But our concept of civilian control of the military needs updating. Most who invoke it apply it mechanistically. Non-uniformed people must trump uniformed people in political decision-making. To say this, however, is to make a fetish of increasingly meaningless symbols. We would do better to ask why we have a concept of civilian control of the military in the first place. Ultimately, we care about what we call civilian control of the military, not because we happen to dislike uniforms, but because we want to ensure the responsible use of force in the public interest. We want to prevent arbitrariness, ensure accountability, and safeguard human rights and the rule of law. In a world in which the maintenance of power depends solely upon brute force, civilian control of those who possess and know how to use the tools of brute force matters. It's the only way to keep the palace guard from deciding that the throne is more comfortable than the barracks and acting accordingly. But today, power is maintained through far more subtle and varied means. Brute force still matters, but so does technical know-how. As warfare becomes both more personalized and less dependent on indiscriminate lethality, control over money, networks, and information is becoming as crucial as control over tanks and grenades. Given this, our current civilian control paradigm is surely neither the only way nor the best way to achieve the goals of preventing arbitrariness or abuses of power. On the contrary, if anything, it is the political establishment's current reluctance to acknowledge the blurry lines between war and peace, civilian and military, that presents the greatest threat to the core values that underlie the notion of civilian control. Recall the civilian-military tensions and misunderstandings of 2009, or the more recent executive branch legal gymnastics around the 2001 authorization for use of military force. If this is the best our current models of civilian control of the military can get us, it's time to toss them aside. The best route to preventing the misuse of the tools of coercion remains what it has always been: robust laws, processes, and institutions designed to ensure that all forms of power are exercised accountably, combined with an engaged and informed citizenry and a military that is integrated with society as a whole. The game of law versus the game of life. To a lawyer, nothing beats a good game of law. It stands to reason. Law is the game lawyers are trained to play. In law school, the pedagogic emphasis is on learning to think like a lawyer, and law students quickly come to understand that law and justice are two quite different things. The law is about rules and precedents, and the careful parsing of words and phrases. Often the law is precisely what the International Criminal Tribunal's appeals chamber said it shouldn't be: the product or slave of logic or intellectual hair-splitting. Justice is a far messier and more dangerous concept. Mention justice and emotions quickly start running high. This gives lawyers even more incentive to stick to law. When lawyers talk about war, they like to talk about armed conflict, the legal distinctions between international and non-international armed conflicts, and the legislative definition of traditional military activities. Lawyers like to talk about collateral damage and proportionality and incidental harm, and debate the quantum of activity that constitutes direct participation in hostilities. To buttress their arguments, lawyers cite other lawyers and legal scholars and judges. They argue by syllogism and analogy, citing past cases and commentaries to prove that the concept of co-belligerency can be mapped onto the newer notion of associated forces, or that the newly articulated unwilling or unable doctrine merely restates older rules about neutrality. It's probably not a coincidence that President Obama is a former University of Chicago law lecturer, or that it was lawyers and legal academics like UC Berkeley's John Yoo who came up with justifications for CIA black sites and enhanced interrogation during the Bush administration. More than half of U.S. senators hold law degrees, along with more than a third of the House of Representatives. The Secretary of State and the Secretary of Homeland Security are lawyers, too. Somehow lawyers have come to dominate Washington debates about war, and that's a shame. Legal categories should reflect a society's deepest moral beliefs. But ask a lawyer if something's a good idea, and odds are he'll tell you instead whether he thinks it's legally permissible. If we live today in a world in which everything has become war and the military has become everything, it is partly because far too many top decision-makers have spent the last 15 years playing the game of law instead of the game of life. For lawyers, the game of law is safe and rule-bound. He who hews to the law can do no wrong. Whatever is not prohibited is permitted, we reason. If indefinite detention and mass surveillance aren't clearly illegal, they must be legal. If U.S. targeted killings are not manifestly unlawful, they must be lawful. And if they're lawful, they needn't keep us up at night, dreaming of dead and broken bodies. When you leave the game of law for the game of life, you're thrown back into the messy world of policy and morality. Suddenly you have to argue about right and wrong, good and evil, fear and hope, cruelty and compassion. Few lawyers are good at that sort of conversation, but it's a conversation we need to have. As technologies and geopolitics have changed, the legal categories and institutions we once thought we could rely upon to protect our rights and our lives have become more and more arbitrary, with potentially fearsome consequences for American democracy, for individual rights and the rule of law, and for the fragile international order that for decades has stood between us and global chaos. As we have seen, there is nothing natural or inevitable about the legal and cultural categories with which we are currently operating, or the rules associated with those categories. No divine power proclaimed that war should be defined in a particular manner, or that certain tasks and no others should be the proper province of those wearing uniforms. We came up with the concepts, definitions, laws, and institutions that have come to be so freighted with significance, and we can change them. In particular, there is nothing eternal about the legal constructs inherited by post-9/11 America. The modern law of war is hardly sacred. It should be viewed as no more than what it is, a somewhat arbitrary set of legal constructs and categories created mainly by the post-World War II West to reflect the realities, assumptions, and aspirations of that time. Like Melanesian or Liberian or Native American war rituals, the modern law of war represents only a particular society's efforts to label, order, and constrain violence at a particular moment in time. Law never does this more than imperfectly, but law and institutions can and should be reimagined when the imperfections grow too glaring. We don't have to accept a world in which the globe is a battlefield in a boundaryless war that can never end, and law has lost any ability to guide or constrain us. If the secrecy and lack of accountability of U.S. targeted killings bothers us, or we worry that mass surveillance will enable government abuses, we can mandate new checks and balances that transcend the traditional war, peace, and foreign domestic categories. If we don't want future technologies to encourage the reckless use of force or coercion, we can search for new rules and institutions to manage them. If we don't want our military to become too hidebound to adapt to new challenges, we can change the way we recruit, train, and treat those who serve, and change the way we define the military's role. If we worry that the tensions between human rights, national self-defense, and sovereignty are pushing us toward global instability, we can create new rules and institutions for global decision-making. We tend to forget this. Instead, we defer to the lawyers. We ask, does the law define such and such kinds of contested relationships as armed conflict? Does the law permit State A to use force inside the borders of State B in such and such circumstances? Does the law permit us to locate an ordinary young man thousands of miles away and guiltlessly transform him, with the push of a button, into a mass of pulverized flesh and bone? We should be asking a far more urgent question. What kind of world do we want to live in? And how do we get from here to there? It's never too late to be brave. Think of those flawed but visionary men who signed the Declaration of Independence, pledging their lives, their fortunes, and their sacred honor to a revolutionary dream of unalienable rights. Think of Francis Lieber and Henri Dunant, who longed to make the battlefield less cruel, or young Dražen Erdemović, torn apart by guilt and shame, but still determined to tell the world of the slaughter burning at his conscience. Think of Sister Rachele, who rescued so many girls from the Lord's Resistance Army, or Matthew Lequena, who stayed when he could have left. Or think of those exhausted diplomats at the United Nations conference in 1945, struggling to look beyond the smoldering battlefields of Europe and Japan, beyond the crematoria of the Nazi concentration camps, the devastated ruins of Tokyo and Dresden, and the 60 million dead, and draw up the plans instead for a world in which aggressive war would be illegal, and every state would respect the dignity and worth of the human person. None of them achieved everything they hoped for. Dražen Erdemović couldn't bring back the innocents he killed. Sister Rachele couldn't save all her girls. Matthew Lequena couldn't save himself. And the planners of the United Nations never came close to achieving their most ambitious goals. Still, without their courage, without their stubborn insistence on imagining a better future, think how much we'd have lost. The American democracy, created by the Declaration of Independence, was far from perfect, but it was better than tyranny and the divine right of kings. The Lieber Code and the Geneva Conventions didn't eliminate suffering on the battlefield, but they made many wars less indiscriminately vicious. Erdemović, Sister Rachele, and Lequena couldn't rescue everyone, but they brought a little bit of humanity to the Earth's dark places. And though the United Nations didn't end war, it helped rein in conflict for decades. If the dream of human rights embedded in the UN Charter has never been fully realized, it has inspired millions of activists to demand justice and freedom all around the world. We try and we try and we try, and sometimes things get better. Today, as the boundaries around war grow indistinct and war's toxins begin to bleed into ordinary life, it's time to try again. How Everything Became War and the Military Became Everything, Tales from the Pentagon, was written by Rosa Brooks and read by Gabra Zachman, with an introduction read by the author. Editing and post-production by Like 2,000 Pounds. This has been a presentation of Simon & Schuster Audio. How Everything Became War and the Military Became Everything, Tales from the Pentagon, is available in print from Scribner.